All right. Hello, everyone. Bonjour à tous. Je vais parler en anglais parce que j'ai préparé en anglais. Désolé. I hope that's okay. Thank you for inviting me to this talk. It's a pleasure to be here. You what? Louder?
Yeah.
All right. How's that?
Fine.
Better? Okay. So I have a lot of stuff today and not too much time, but I want to talk about the next generation of virtual learning and what we as developers and users of open educational resources will be looking at. This is the state of the art right now, and it's a bit hard to see. So this is my talk. The simple landscape that we started with 2 decades ago has become complex, and we saw some evidence of the complexity in Gilbert's talk, which was completely accurate and forward-looking. This represents even more of the complexity that we're going to see in the future. Now we begin, well, Gilbert talked about these, and you're familiar with these, and other of you will talk about these. Open education resource repositories. Right now, open educational resources in the form of videos and texts, PDFs, audio files, animations, these are widely available through different repositories, and there are various systems that also enable people to create these resources. And so we've got a fairly well-developed ecosystem for open educational resources, and we're beginning now to think about where we take that next. And where we take that next in the mind of many people, and I believe accurately, is in things like open pedagogy, open teaching, things like, was mentioned earlier, open assessment, things like open scenarios, etc. But these are beginning to raise questions about licensing. They're beginning to raise questions about what is the basis of open pedagogy, what is the basis of open education. And I think that a big part of this has to do with open learning and open educational resource networks. And what develops as we use technology and as we use resources openly is we develop these networks of interaction. People have heard me talk about that before. Another stream of thought related to this and derived from this is the idea of open educational resources as being produced not by content publishers, not by educators or universities or governments, but by students themselves in the process of thinking and learning openly. So we see, for example, things like the Assignment Bank in Digital Storytelling 106 by Jim Groom, his course, where he has students contribute assignments to a repository, and then other students in the class pick whatever they want and do the assignment. He's also working on something called Domain of One's Own, where students, participants in online courses, have their own website, have their own blogging engine, create resources to share among each other and for the future. And there's talk about something called renewable assignments. David Wiley has talked about this, Heather Ross has talked about this, Christina Hendricks has talked about this, shifting from the concept of an assignment that we do in a class as something that only the teacher sees to the idea of an assignment that we do in class as something that everybody sees. So this is kind of the ground now. This is what people are talking about, but this is just the beginning of what is going to be, I think, some substantial changes in our understanding of what it means to create open educational resources and to use open educational resources. We begin to see this as the resources become more practical, as the resources become to be not just things that we use in a class, but things that begin to get used in the wider society. At UBC, for example, they've created a system of open case studies, and this is again from Christina Hendricks. They focus on topics like sustainability, on environment. The cases on this open case studies website are open educational resources, but they're also resources that are used in wider applications in the general public. We might call them, and I'm making this up right now, open social resources. There, that's a new term. You've just seen it coined, unless it's already been invented, which is also possible. We are also seeing, and this is really important, an increase in the complexity of the resources. Now, Gilbert talked about, you know, the media and the people and the roles and the scenarios and how the different parts would be put together. There are going to be, there are now, multiple systems and multiple ways for these parts to be put together. Here's something called H5P. It stands for HTML5 package, which doesn't really explain a lot, but the idea is that it makes it easy for people to create and share and reuse interactive HTML5 content. For example, on the left there you see a video editor. Please let that not be my phone. and this is a video editor that's created by somebody and then shared, and other people can use this resource to edit video. On the right-hand side, you see the control panel for the H5P application that they're developing. If you follow the website there, h5p.org, you'll find a whole pile of resources related to that. Oops, this one. Another thing that Gilbert talked about that has been important to me for many, many years is the idea of content syndication. At its simplest level, content syndication, or sometimes called content aggregation, is the idea that content is produced in many places and then brought together automatically so that you can present resources from many different sites in a single environment. When we created, George Siemens and I, the massive open online course in 2008, we used an application that I wrote called Grasshopper, and the core of Grasshopper was content syndication. And we combined some of the ideas that we had seen before us. For example, the idea of students creating their own resources. For example, the idea of students using things like Google Groups or Second Life or any of the other applications that were available on the internet at the time. And we set up our system so that people could use these applications and create content, whatever it was. We would bring it into the course and then share it with the other participants in the course. That's what made the massive open online course possible. It was this distributed creation and sharing of resources. What that meant was we, the instructors, did not have to produce all the content, yay, and it also meant that we did not have to interact with each and every one of the 2,000 students. They interacted with each other. That was very important. Since then, there have been a number of aggregation systems. I talked about Jim Groom earlier with DS106. He uses FeedPress, which is a plugin for the WordPress blogging engine. There's also a Google product called FeedBurner, which you can use to create RSS feeds. But that was the state of the art, maybe 5 years ago. And things are changing because it's the internet and things change. one of the big things that has happened, Gilbert talked about RDF, resource description frameworks, and the semantic web. What I've been seeing is that the number of different formats that we have to support in order to aggregate has multiplied. There is RSS, there's a similar format called Atom, then there are things like application programming interfaces, or APIs, that are specific to individual applications. Often these produce data in something called JSON, JavaScript Object Notation. You don't need to remember this stuff. I just want you to see that there's a bunch of different formats. So we developed something called Scrapy. Well, we didn't develop Scrapy. What am I saying? Other people developed something called Scrapy, or Scrapy, depends on how you pronounce it, which is a Python framework for aggregating content of different types, whether it's from websites, from RSS feeds, from Twitter or Facebook, from JSON, from application programming interfaces, etc. So we set it up, we set up a version of this, and we have little aggregators for each of the different types. We used Scrapy to build something called BYARD at NRC. Well, why did we do that? Well, I have a site on my server called MOOC.ca because, you know, I was involved in MOOCs. What MOOC.ca does is it aggregates or brings in information about MOOCs that are being offered around the world. So you see an illustration there. So you can see a MOOC from Zhutang X in China. There's also MOOCs. It's kind of hard to see because the image is small. But you see FutureLearn in there. You see edX in there. Now, MOOC.ca uses Grasshopper for the website. Grasshopper, of course, is the thing that I built for MOOCs. But it uses BYARD as an aggregator. I know, lots of different software applications being juggled around, right? What I also want to do, because as Gilbert and others have talked about, there are repositories of open educational resources all over the place. I want to use MOOC.ca to aggregate resources. But the idea here isn't just to have a website where you can find resources. That's been done, right? And that is probably, you know, the state of the art 5 years ago. In the future, we're going to want to take this and feed it forward into other applications. And that's what the bulk of this talk is about. So here's an example of that sort of thing. You've probably heard of open data, right? So governments, the United Nations, educational agencies, companies, they publish their data. It might be geographical data, might be employment data. We have a project where we're gathering data about jobs that are available for people and the competencies involved, etc. They make this data available, usually through an API, usually in the form of JSON, but it varies. And they make it available. Well, open data is something that can be thought of and should be thought of as an open educational resource. Now, sure, it's not pedagogically oriented, it doesn't have learning scenarios, but it's incredibly useful for learning. And this paper that I cite here, Open Data as Open Educational Resources, Case Studies of Emerging Practice, from a couple of years ago, talks about five projects that do exactly that. There's a civic engagement project in Italy that uses open data, an introduction to programming assignments, so aspiring computer programmers use open data to practice with, article level metrics, so they look at open publication archives, look at the reading statistics, and do things like, oh, this article was read most of all on Wednesday if it was shared on Facebook. But if it was shared on Twitter, it's read most of all on Tuesday. Go figure. Geodata and land walks in Wales. So somebody, you know, I mean, again, this is the idea of open data being used to create an open educational resource that is of practical value in the community, in this case, Wales, and open data for sustainable development. These are actual projects that exist now. So let's take this all a step further. This is something called CodePen. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but basically the idea is it's a website. You can go to it with your web browser. And it shows three windows on the top, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And what you do is you type in the code, and then whatever you typed in will play in the window below as though it were a website. So you can change the code and it changes in real time. So that's a really fun thing to play with, but what people do is they prepare a code pen, or they just call them a pen. So I've prepared a pen, right? And they use it to share their ideas. And there are directories and repositories of code pen addresses. And people use it to illustrate a programming technique, to show, well, this thing is Saber. I can't play it because I don't have time, but if you hover over the saber, little lightsabers come out. It's very cool. And so these are open educational resources, aren't they? They are explicitly used for teaching purposes, but they're not what we would normally think of as an open educational resource. It's a website plus the programming in the background of the website that makes it work, plus whatever code the person has put into this. So you're actually getting content from a variety of locations. Taking it a bit further, because that's the way this talk works, there's a thing called IPython and Jupyter Notebook. Now, Python is a programming language with a very bad name. IPython stands for Interactive Python. So it's the same concept we just saw. You have a window, and on one side you have your Python code, your program that you're writing in Python, and on the other side you see the results of that program display in real time. So program, 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 hit run, boink, and your program runs. It's really useful. It's especially useful for learning how to program. I learned how to program Python at a site called Codecademy. I should have put the link to that in there. And Codecademy, basically, on the left-hand side, it gives me instructions, then it has me do some code, then it shows me where I went wrong. Or if I was successful, it shows the successful code. Again, it's an open educational resource. Just as an aside, people talk about licensing all the time. The licensing question here becomes absurd and ridiculous, right? It's, you know, the idea of open educational resources as, the chapters in a book that you bring together or the lessons in a course that you bring together, this doesn't resemble that really anymore. Now, taking this a step further is a thing called Jupyter Notebook. It's again Python. It's interactive Python, but basically what it is a notebook or a website that looks like a notebook. And you have text, just like you would normally have text, but then you have, they call them cells, a cell with some Python code in it. And then you have right below the cell the results of the Python code. And so now you have a way of distributing a resource that can provide instruction, shows the code right there, and then it shows the results of the code. Now, you want to follow this link. You'll get these slides later, so you'll be able to follow all of the links on these slides. you really want to follow this link. It's a gallery of Jupyter notebooks. That on the right is just a small snippet of them. That on the left is an example of, and just a clipping from a Jupyter notebook. There you see the code, and there underneath the code is what results. The code is programming that will draw that lion. Now, what's really interesting is the Jupyter notebook has Python code. This Python code reaches out to a third party for open data. What this code did is it reached out for open data, how to draw a tiger, brought that data in, processed it, and rendered the tiger right in the notebook. Change the location, you get a different animal. Jupyter notebooks exist for all kinds of data processing tasks that you can practice and show just by working with the notebook. These are not simply tasks that have to do with computing. You're working with real data on real problems. You can use, for example, a Jupyter notebook to run a scenario about the environmental impact of, say, a plant proposal or a civic ordinance, because you have all of the data and you have functions that process that data. I could spend the rest of this talk talking about Jupyter notebooks. Please follow this link. Now, the neat thing about Jupyter notebooks is I can run them on my computer. I can run them all by myself. There's different ways of doing it. I can download and install Python on my computer, which is what I've done here. If I had more time, I'd be opening them and showing you. Or I can go to a website, which is a Jupyter notebook viewer, and look at the notebooks on the web using somebody else's instance of Python. So they're very accessible, but they're accessible not simply over the web, they're accessible in the sense that this would work even without an internet connection, because all you need is the Jupyter notebook, the code, and the data, and if you have that locally, it will all work. So now that's beginning to raise some interesting ideas. Why do we think open educational resources would only be used in virtual learning in a learning management system on the web? They could be used anywhere. After all, it's all about this networking, right? So let's take this further. This is the Actionable Data Book. It's something created by, it's a standard being created by IEEE, the Learning Technology Subcommittee on which I sit is working on this now. And it's working with EPUB3, which is an internet publishing standard. The idea of the Actionable Data Book is that you can use mobile technology, analytics from your actual day-to-day experience, plus rich media, and deliver this through an interactive book. So now you have something on your mobile device that interacts with the environment around you that produces a book that does things or that you can do things with. This is, you know, a step beyond what we normally think of as a learning resource. It's not just a video. It's not just some text. It's actually a fairly complex piece of computer code. That's why you want your students to create it, because otherwise it'd be really expensive. So, now we move forward to something called XAMPP. My sample is... On this USB stick, which I happen to have just handy, I have a fully functioning Apache web server, a database, and programming languages, including Python, Perl, which is my favorite, and PHP. I can run anything on this. I could, if I wanted, I don't know anything about this computer, but if I wanted, I could close the presentation, go to this and start up Moodle or whatever right here in this computer without an internet connection. So this is the idea of coding resources in a box, or educational resources in a box, so that we can deliver these things without, again, having to have internet resources. Now, one application, which I'm sure you've thought of, is for places where there's no internet. But it's just handy to have your own web server when you're walking around, because you don't always have your computer with you. But if you have your web server, any computer is your computer. So, I said you can run Moodle on it. There's a project called Spoodle. This is something that other people did. I've been playing around with it because it's fun. I have Spoodle on here as well. Spoodle is an up-to-date portable installation of Moodle. So you can set up an entire learning management system as an educational resource. Now again, this is not what you were thinking of as an open educational resource, right? You're thinking of a bit of text or a video or a picture or animation. I'm thinking of a complete web server with Moodle, with a database that can be used for some specific thing, whatever it might be. And I could make that as precise as I want or as general as I wanted. So that works, that exists now, you can use that now. So taking all of this a step further, because that's what we do, right? I've been looking at running these applications in other applications, because that's what portability buys us. Here's a simple example. I use the Firefox web browser. The Firefox web browser runs extensions. So I created an extension, it didn't take me too long, that will run Grasshopper. That's the application I built to run MOOCs, right? It's also the application I use for MOOC.ca. I run that in a sidebar in Firefox. So you can see, here's Firefox. Here it is loading. Here it is running in the side. And so now what I can do is I use Grasshopper to aggregate stuff. It shows up in the sidebar. I click on something in the sidebar. It shows up in the main part of the browser. Then I can write something, I can use it to create a new resource, I can do whatever I want because I have Grasshopper in my sidebar. So that's kind of handy. Wouldn't it be great if I could do all that on a stick? Well, to a large degree, I can. But there's other ways of doing this. This is a browser called Vivaldi. And Vivaldi has all of the sidebar stuff built in. So I did not have to write an extension for this. All I had to do is type in the information about Grasshopper. Now I have Grasshopper running in XAMPP. So when I'm browsing in Vivaldi, I use my stick to give me my application and then the live internet data to give me whatever I'm using as my live internet data. You see how things are getting complex, right? We've got different things on the go here. Again, licensing and things like that, these questions sort of become irrelevant. A lot of the things about, you know, it must be CC BY. I look at that and I say, well, what part of it? Because there are so many different parts of it. Does it all have to be? In fact, it all works no matter what the licensing is. The important thing here is I can access it. If I can access it, I can do stuff with it. Why worry just about web browsers? Here's Microsoft Word. Now, Microsoft Word has a relatively new feature which allows you to put references and research materials in a right-hand sidebar. And it's this resizing has made it a little off there, but you can see it in the right-hand sidebar. So this is a paper that I'm writing. I'm writing about a project that I did, but in the sidebar, I have my research, this is all of my research from previous papers that I've written in Word. So it's a bit limited, right? But it's still quite a bit of stuff. And so I'm able to just drag it, and it creates the reference for me. No typing of references or anything like that. And it's, I can search through it. I can look for new resources. I can use Bing and search the web, etc. What I want to put there is Grasshopper or something similar, so that as I'm working in Microsoft Word, I have all of my open educational resources right there that I can use and drag in. That would work really well in PowerPoint as well. That would work really well in Excel or any application. This is a general thing, right? Right now it's just Word, but tomorrow is going to be any application we're working with. We will be able to access our resources that came from wherever. Data streams, papers, multimedia, even YouTube videos, whatever. Now, let's get messy with this, because we've got all of these applications. All of these applications run on different platforms. And I've learned from hard experience, if you try to run them all on the same computer in the same operating system, you crash your computer. This is not good. But if I could run them each in their own individual box, then I can run them, and if one of them crashes, no problem, the rest of them still work. This is a solution that has been adopted by enterprise computing people for many years. This is old technology, which means by now it's really stable and well-known technology, and it's just now moving from your internet service provider to your desktop. So, Mac users will be familiar with Parallels. Parallels creates a virtual image of a Windows computer on a Macintosh. They really need that because they have a Macintosh and they suffer so. I'm just kidding. Another option that they have had to run, say, Linux, and people using a Windows computer can run Linux using something called VMware. VM for virtual machine, right? Oracle produced their own version called VirtualBox. Microsoft computers now have something called Hyper-V. It's actually built right into the operating system, but you don't always have access to it. You have to get a Microsoft server computer, not just a Microsoft home use computer. Or for my computer, to access Hyper-V, I had to get Windows 10 Pro rather than Windows 10 Home. But if I have a home computer, I can run VirtualBox and then I'm okay. So I can run VirtualBox on my computer and pretend that it supports Hyper-V. I know, it doesn't make sense, does it? And then there's an open source version of all of this called Zen Server, which does basically the same thing. So think about this. You have a computer, and then in your computer, you have a software-defined second computer. So on my Windows machine, I can run Apple, or I can run Linux, which is what I do. I can, in fact, set up my whole other computer. You remember the one with XAMPP, with my web server and my database engine and my Perl and my Python. So I take all of that, I put it into my Windows computer in a box using server virtualization. So now that's getting pretty handy. In fact, I do use that. I use that so that I can run many different types of Python, many different very special application programs, data processing, whatever. So, to make that work, What I use is something called Vagrant. Vagrant is a piece of software that tells my computer how to deal with a virtual box. I know. So, or you can just remember it like this. Vagrant plus a virtual box is like your own computer, your second computer on your computer. So the nice thing about Vagrant is, here's what I do. I download an image, a Vagrant image from the web. Then I type a command that basically is Vagrant up. And Vagrant will use VirtualBox and launch this image. So now again, I have an entire computer, server, database, everything, as a very easy to access open educational resource. And there are, even now as I speak, and in fact for the last number of years, repositories of Vagrant images or boxes out there on the web. So I can download and run, well, a fully defined instance of WordPress or a fully defined instance of Moodle or, you know, some natural language analytics. No formatting, no configuring. I just download it and run it. Now, that's a pretty nice resource to have. Computer science professors know all about this because if they're teaching their students, say, how to build a neural net, which is going to require 5 different pieces of software all set up for a specific computer, they don't do that. They just download a single image, put that image on all of the computers, and then they have the students run Vagrant up and they're set. It takes about 2 minutes. 2 minutes if they're slow. Okay, so here's an example. Scotchbox is a box that I like. It makes me think of scotch. So what it does is, well, it's an example of this web server in a box. I download and run, I just type Vagrant up, and up comes my Scotchbox, and then I go to my web browser, and I type in this address. This address will not work on your computer. It only works on mine because I'm running Scotchbox. If you ran Scotchbox, then this address would point to your virtual computer. So Homestead is another one. Homestead is more configurable. They'll show you the whole installation script, and you can customize that however you want. Pretty good, huh? This is the new world of open educational resources, but we're not done. So, anyhow, Vagrant is in itself a pretty good learning environment. So we don't really need the learning management system so much for this, but so here's what this project has done. This is from Tony Hurst at the Open University, who I will say is way ahead of everyone on this. You want to learn about how to make all of this work, talk to Tony Hurst. He's the guy to talk to. So he's got something here, one of his many things, distributing virtual machines that include a virtual desktop for students. And on that desktop, they have Jupyter notebooks preloaded with all the notebooks that they need for that class. So what we've got is open data being used by Jupyter notebooks that are being run in a virtual desktop in a virtual machine on the student's computer, and it doesn't matter what the student's computer is, it'll run on anything. It'll run on this, it'll run on this. I don't know if it'll run on iPad, I've never tried that, but it will eventually. Eventually it'll run on your phone, it'll run on your watch, but I don't think we're quite there yet. It's coming. The problem with Vagrant and VirtualBox is you have to bring in an entire computer stack. But I use a bunch of different applications. I mentioned I use ScraePy, a Python application to aggregate data. I have Grasshopper, which is in Perl. I would like to run some natural language processing for my input, which is in another Python, but a different version of Python. I can't put them all in the same box. The solution for that is called Docker. What Docker is it takes all the different pieces of your application and gives them each their own separate self-standing container. So I can have my database in one container, I can have my web server in a container, I can have my aggregator in a container, I can have my natural language processor in a container, and then I connect them all up. Docker is what made Coursera possible. Docker is what made edX possible. Not open edX, but the real edX that they use for 100,000 students. Because in the back end, they use Docker. The thing with Docker is if you're using these containers, if you get a lot of people, you just add another container. If your database is overloaded, you just add another container. So you can scale using Docker. And it's all on virtual machines. So there's no problem with scaling. So Docker has been widely used in the last 4 or 5 years. I guess 4 or 5 years. Canvas, which is a learning management system, they have a Docker image. So you could download the Canvas Docker image and run it on Docker. You install Docker on your computer. You basically run what they call a Docker file, and it will grab all the components that it needs from the World Wide Web and organize a bunch of containers for you. Or you can run Big Blue Button in Docker. Big Blue Button's a special case because it's an online conferencing, piece of online conferencing software. It takes a lot of resources. Best to put it in its own container. You can run Moodle in Docker. Of course, why not? You run Moodle anywhere. That gives you a lot of options, right? So here's Bitnami, which is a software distributing service that will allow you to run Moodle on Docker, or you can run Moodle on something called Kubernetes, which is another thing that does the same thing as Docker. Now, most of the time, we're talking about running these things on our own computer. But if we don't have our own computer, or we don't want to invest in a lot of server infrastructure for our college or our university, usually what we do, I do this for my website, is I get a cloud infrastructure provider. So Amazon Web Services is, as you can see from the chart, the major cloud infrastructure provider. But there's also Azure from Microsoft, Bluemix from IBM Cloud, Google Cloud, Oracle Cloud, and if you go and you talk to Jim Groom, remember Jim Groom of DS106? He has his own, I've forgotten what it's called. That's terrible. But that's what he runs Domain of One's Own on. Cloud computing has clear applications in education. As I mentioned, it's used for Coursera and edX. Code.org uses it as well. This, again, is the secret behind these MOOCs. And these containers are, again, open educational resources. So a single Docker container containing a database of, demographic data or geographical reports, seismic surveys, whatever you can think of, that's an open educational resource. You can make just that database available as a container that anybody can move and make part of their own application. So, and now we're seeing today applications, things like mobile learning for augmented reality learning, using this kind of distributed framework to create serious mobile games. Because it's run in the cloud, you can access it off your mobile phone. He's got 18 seconds, I have 26 seconds. I'm taking the 26 seconds. Here's an example of what advanced distributed learning is doing, using similar approaches to capture and record learning activity data using something called XAPI or Experience API. It goes back to this idea of aggregation and application programming interfaces. Right now, here's a link to a study, Docker Images to Build Open Educational Resources. Right now, here's a link to Creativity in the Open workshop that took place about a week ago in British Columbia. That's Christina Hendricks again. Right now, there's a thing called UHack Weekend where they're messing around with this stuff in Tasmania. So this is state of the art right now for the creation and distribution of open educational resources. And that's where we stop. But you can only imagine what the future will be. These slides, this presentation, and with luck, the video of this presentation, with even more luck, the audio of this presentation, will all be available on my website at www.downs.ca. Thank you very much. Questions? Sure.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's very interesting for me, especially because I'm professor in the National Institute of Computer Science. And my research is computer security. So it's very interesting. The first part of your presentation is about coding platform. Mm-hmm. And I think this platform use Ajax, I think, or Web 2.0, like an interactive coding platform that is very useful in learning and e-learning. And the second part is just very much as the last and in my last intervention, I asked you a question. So the second part is about virtualization. I think that you talked about virtual box, VMware, etc. And Docker has a very last technology to virtualization. So
yes.
Docker, I think, is very interesting as a container that we use to code, and like Docker Compose, to compose, for example, WordPress, Apache, and the database, etc. But my question is about security. So this is the problem, because the image and the Docker and the container, these images are not all official. So we can put some content and very vulnerable content, and this would be triggering some flows or some kind of impact in our operating system. So, what about security?
Well, yeah. So, yeah, there's always security. I mean, your observation is exactly right. There are unofficial and potentially insecure containers out there. One of the things I like about server virtualization generally, and even the code pens and things like that, is that the application and the interface is sandboxed from the rest of your computer. So there's only a limited set of interactions and a set that you define of interactions from the Docker container to your computer. So that limits the risk. It doesn't eliminate the risk, but it limits the risk. The second part of it, of course, is what is needed, and certainly is part of the picture, is a mechanism for signing and verifying these boxes so that when you're receiving a distribution, you know that you're receiving the distribution from a source that you trust, and you can know it because it's digitally signed. So I think that's the best I can say about security now, but it's a very large topic. Moodle is not official. Oh, yeah. I don't think there's an official Moodle Docker image, but I know people are messing around with it, so.
Okay, thank you. There is another question over there.
Hello. This is Ihab from Megan. Thanks for
the
rich presentation. This is Ihab from Libya. I would like to thank you for your rich presentation. What you have mentioned that we know that OER for simple users, and these users maybe they are not IT oriented, so they hard for them to deal with the exam and virtual box, virtual machine, and install Apache's and MySQL program. So what I'm asking is there a turn in solutions that can be used for learning management systems like Moodle or Clapboard directly to provide offline learning management systems? You know that all your OER can be accessed online, and there is a date for internet access in most of the countries.
Yeah. I want to say not yet. The Spoodle that I talked about on the USB, that exists. The things like VirtualBox and Docker, it's more difficult to run them. I mean, you run them on a computer, but it's more difficult to just have a plug-and-play version because they have to install some software on the computer to run. So my thinking, though, on this, on the whole ease of use question, there's two parts. The first part is, this is a lot easier than it would be without it. If you can imagine trying to set up each of your students' computers to do data analytics, for example, it'd be impossible. Well, not impossible, but it'd take you all year, right? It would be very complex. So this is a lot simpler than that. Secondly, I think that if we can get to the point where it's part of the operating system, like Hyper-V is with Windows, then it'll simply be a matter of you bring in the container, you double-click on the container, and boom, a whole new computer runs, no matter what computer you're using. That's probably, you know, in the next few years, we're probably going to see that. And then that'll provide the ease of use that you're looking for. It's still a bit in the future, though, I would say. On the learning management system side, they're trying to do the same kind of thing with LTI, Learning Tools Interoperability. But I think that that's, you know, it's good for large learning management systems, not nearly as useful as for a simple personal desktop.
Merci beaucoup, nous allons nous arrêter là, instruction des organisateurs. Donc merci à tous aux deux conférenciers.
Merci beaucoup.
Donc je n'ai pas question des instructions pour la pause. Est-ce qu'il y a une pause?
Oui, il y a une pause maintenant.
Ah, il y a une pause quand même.
Une pause maintenant.
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Vous avez de la chance. 20 minutes.
Crap.